But today is VE Day. The war is
the
over.
The newly crowned queen waves from the balcony.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has landed.
Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Bailey Gifford. Capital at risk.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to The Advice Show. From advising clients to practice management, this podcast will give you UK and global insights into the financial planning profession. I'm Victoria Bell, Senior Reporter at Citywire New Model Advisor. The Advice Guidance Review has stirred up intense debate among advisors. The original simplified advice regime aimed to encourage people with £10,000 in cash savings to invest through a stocks and shares ISA while receiving a stripped-back form of advice. This was scrapped following pushback from the industry. The regulator will instead incorporate that work into its wider advice guidance boundary review. One advisor who was openly critical of the original regime was Helena Wardle, who called it a band-aid on a stab wound. Great quote, Helena. Today we're joined by Helena, founder of the soon-to-be-launched Money Means. She is also a financial planner at Smith and Wardle Financial Planning. Hi, Helena.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. I think I'm right in saying that we met at the Lancaster event,
yeah,
didn't we? Where did I meet you? Were you getting a cookie or something?
I think so.
I think that's right. Yeah. We were talking about it. So at that event, Kate Blatchford Hick, Director of Consumer Investments at the FCA, was giving an update on the Advice Guidance Boundary Review. I don't think you saw it, but I think you've watched it since.
Yeah.
What did you think of that update?
I think they'll always hold a line, won't they? So it was very formal in its presentation. But I think we shouldn't, as an industry, underestimate the ambition with it. Particularly from Treasury.
Right.
Because there's the complications that happened as a result of RDR is that we have effectively cut out an enormous amount of people from getting access to advice.
Yeah.
And what I find interesting is how high on the agenda those items are.
Yeah.
They are not going to wait around to start acting on it. And I think this is why I'm relatively optimistic,
yeah,
about what it can mean for the industry, because I think fundamentally there's very little incentive from the industry to do anything about this.
Right, yeah.
And the longer we leave it and the more we ignore the issue, the more this is going to be a problem for our industry in the future, because people are already disillusioned with us to an extent, because we're not speaking to majority of the people. We're not helping majority of the people, yeah, which means most consumers don't actually see the value in, yeah, advice. And fundamentally, that's one of the first things as an industry we need to address. Mm-hmm. So I was interested in what Kate was saying, because as a starting point, they pointed out that they were looking for this to be a solution that's commercially viable,
yeah,
and sustainable for the industry.
Yeah.
And that they were looking for solutions that consumers were willing to pay for.
Yeah.
Now, that's fine. It's a great ambition. There's a huge flaw in their thinking.
Right.
Because all of the regulation and all of the solutions proposed, including targeted support, is still fundamentally products.
Right.
Product-based.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that is a huge, huge barrier,
yeah,
which has been shown in even what the FCA is proposing,
yeah,
and in what Kate was saying. You know, yeah, she's saying that their core aim is to find a solution that customers are willing to pay for, and that is commercially viable.
Yeah.
Well, if we look at an assets under management solution,
yeah,
for mass market, we're going to fail.
After she gave her update, I don't know if you saw the Q&A, but she said that she had a problem with the characterization that they're more product focused. I mean, is that something that you would agree with?
I think they are product focused. What I'm really concerned about is if they continue to focus on products, they're really going to miss an opportunity to genuinely help people.
Yeah.
And we're going to continue to exclude them.
Mm. Come here. What would your advice be to the FCA if you had anything to do with this regime behind closed doors? What would you advise?
Stop speaking to the same people.
Oh, what do you mean by that?
We do not get a wide enough group of people communicating to them on the challenges and why it's an issue. You know, those rooms have the same people sitting around them, people from large organizations who are disconnected from that client, who doesn't understand what it takes and what is the real barriers. Ultimately, the simplest thing they can do to actually really, really create meaningful innovation is access to data.
Yeah.
If it didn't take a firm 3 months to get that client's access to that data, which they own, by the way, it is that client's data.
Yeah.
If it didn't take that long to get that information with 4 or 5 phone calls, how many chases, how many missed information?
Yeah.
That process would be significantly more efficient.
What does the FCA do with data? Like, what does it actually, do you know anything about? What happens to us? What's the...
Effectively, the way they're regulated at the moment is through data, isn't it? And they get the submissions of data and that's how they use it. I don't think they fundamentally understand what the challenges are because they're not speaking to firms about what is actually causing lack of innovation and advice.
But so large firms, I mean, they have a little bit more, I suppose, capacity to speak to the FCA. But I think feedback from advisors that I've received has been, we just don't have time. We don't have time. I mean, is it a kind of a fold? Should advisors be making more of an effort? Let's say independent advisors.
I don't blame them.
Yeah.
It's dead easy to build an advice business. The demand is significant.
Yeah.
It doesn't take a lot for you to build up a reasonable client base and earn a good living and build a lifestyle business.
Mm.
I'm not going to blame anyone for doing that.
Yeah.
The problem with that is there's no competition. We don't have serious competition.
Mm.
And the result of that is there's no innovation.
A lot of the advice or a lot of the feedback that I got from advisors was, how are we going to be able to offer this simplified advice? They won't. But how can you make it commercially viable, I suppose, for those firms?
This is what I think is fundamentally a challenge in the industry. That if you look at the traditional model, assets under management, you're never going to build a commercial business.
Mm. Yeah.
Because you're playing an incredibly long game, which investors would not have patience for. And I don't think you'll accrue enough assets to make that model work. You just won't.
Yeah.
But we look at, okay, everyone charges a percentage. And this is hugely frustrating for me because I applied to the innovation pathways. Yeah. So the FCA innovation pathways.
Yeah.
They declined me.
Really?
Do you know why?
Why?
Because I'm charging a subscription fee that they said is unaffordable compared to AUM. Because my pricing would have been £15 a month.
Yeah.
And if you compare that to someone of £5,000 invested, that is more expensive on a percentage basis. That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
We need to step away from trying to say everyone should follow a percentage-based model.
Mm.
If we want commercially viable businesses, we need to look at alternative ways to monetize because we'll never help the mass market otherwise.
Can I ask you, I suppose with advisors, I suppose they're kind of the mind that there is an advice gap. Of course there is. You know, lots of people don't receive financial advice. But I suppose, you know, some advisors are of the mind that people don't have enough money to receive financial advice, right? So what would you say to that?
That's true.
Yeah, yeah.
That's true. But how are you going to build wealth for the future?
Yeah.
You've got to get people to understand the benefits of looking at not just living now, but also focusing on the future. But it's just too hard for them to see the benefits of that.
Yeah.
And I think... ignoring that is just going to create a problem because long term, why would they come back and seek advice in 20 years' time if we haven't spoken to them earlier? We actually made them feel like it's not for them.
Yeah.
This is just for rich people.
Mm.
That's what it is.
It is.
You know,
yeah.
people talk about advice as like it's this luxury service.
Mm.
Fundamentally, people do not understand these principles.
Yeah.
They are not experts. And I hate how much we focus on education.
Mm.
Because yes, people need to understand things, but education's not going to change the world. Like, you cannot educate people to be level 4 diploma qualified. You know, that's the level of detail we put on the internet and on our blogs and here, like, to teach them about money.
Yeah.
You know, they don't, who's got time?
No, nobody has time.
Like, I don't really believe that we can just say that we need to give them more information. More information is available. You Google anything around money and you'll get thousands of hits.
What do you think about the, you know, having advisors who, the FCA's suggestion that advisors with fewer qualifications give this form of advice? Is that...
I see a flaw in that, because what we underestimate is that actually advisors have a broad range of knowledge across different topics for a reason.
Yeah.
Because you can identify gaps or limitations in that situation that you can highlight and point out. Examples I'll give you is, I tested all the coaching services out there. Mm. You know, that was important to us to understand. They all missed an advice opportunity. They missed an opportunity to tell a client he should be seeking advice.
Mm.
Now, I worry about if we're going to say that we will limit people's qualifications to help in those areas, we're really not thinking broadly enough, because actually, why not create a digital service that delivers that? Mm. Why would you need to look at always finding a human to deliver that? Mm. I don't think that's necessary.
Yeah.
If you have a good enough understanding of that client's circumstances and you have a good enough picture, you can digitize this.
So after the Dear, I don't know if you're familiar with the Dear CEO letter to platform CEOs, which warned them about, you know, the margin that they take on client cash. I mean, so AJ Bell pretty quickly hiked up as it's the interest that it gives to its clients. Hargreaves Lansdown, I think in their results last week, they reduced their margin that they take from, I think, about 41 to 36 quietly. They didn't, I don't think, to my mind, they didn't give any explanation. I mean, what is the party sort of over for in this way? I mean, they make so much money on the on this client cash. I mean, what do you...
It shouldn't have been a party in the first place, to be honest. And I think that's the challenge, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's absolutely shouldn't be allowed. Imagine I took half of the returns that my clients make every year and just go, oh, well, it's just part of our profit.
It's
just not okay.
Can I ask you, because I've been asking, so today, actually, I'm not sure if you're aware, but today is the deadline for platforms to stop double dipping. Today, I'm going to be doing a piece on the platforms that were double dipping. And I mean, from what I get from them, it doesn't seem like they've actually changed a lot.
No.
Okay.
It shouldn't be like that, because we're not doing ourselves any favours as an industry when, you know, those kind of practices are normalised and needs. That's why the regulator probably does talk to us like children, because actually that shouldn't happen. Fundamentally, we are a service industry here to serve our customers.
Yeah.
That isn't okay.
Yeah.
So I don't think that helps our integrity as an industry at all.
No. Speaking of service, obviously SJP's results were yesterday. Right. So, I mean, for a bit of background, I'm sure everybody in the advice industry knows this, but the FCA sent out a letter to the 20 of the biggest advice firms in the UK, with asking for information on what service on ongoing fees. It transpires that SJP have put away 400 million in provisions for complaints to do with clients that aren't getting that service. Was that a shock?
No.
Okay.
So for my sins, I reviewed 1,064 FOS complaints relating to advisor fees in 2018 for my master's degree.
Right.
One of the top complaints was ongoing service being paid for but not being received.
Yeah.
So you look at FOS outcomes since the start, April 2013.
Mm.
And you search advisor fees and you link it to pensions and investments and you get over 9,000 complaints.
Wow. Okay.
So we are underestimating how big this issue is, I think.
Mm.
The fact that they put that much money aside gives you a small indication of how big the problem is.
Mm,
And that's across the industry.
Yeah.
We have PE money that's piled into businesses that was all about, you know, how much of their how much ongoing those clients have, and that's a big part of the business value.
Mm.
How much of those clients are being serviced?
Yeah.
How much of those clients are being looked after?
Yeah.
I have seen nothing but indications that this is going to be a much bigger problem than we think, because yeah. fundamentally we're charging for a service that's not being delivered. And I think it comes back to, if we're trying to say that our ongoing value is to send a client a statement mm-hmm. or to have a cup of tea and a biscuit with them,
yeah.
then we really need to have a good look in the mirror.
Is this kind of the tip of the iceberg? I mean, will it transpire that other firms are doing this?
Yes.
Okay.
I think even things like the cost and charges disclosure, clients get sent 5 pages to yeah. work through to say what it's costing them
yeah.
and what the breakdown of costs are. I'm not going to be surprised if this causes a lot of firms major issues.
Yeah.
And actually, to deliver relational advice in a way that's meaningful, you need probably 2 to 3 touch points of a client throughout the year.
Yeah.
You do. So if you're just a large business that have no control over what your advisor's doing, you have no control over, they incentivize because they're self-employed to bring in new fees,
yeah.
then I'm sorry, you're creating a massive, massive issue for yourself.
100%. Can they pivot from this? What do you think they should do? I mean, they do. They have a massive amount of brand loyalty, don't they? And I don't think really... I mean, what do you think? I don't know. I mean, do you think that this will affect them badly?
I think their model was still very pre-RDR.
Right. Happened. Yeah.
I always think the way they operated has reflected that really is a business fundamentally. They never moved on and everyone else had to.
Mm.
I think this is going to be really challenging for them to come back from as a business. They have a very stuffy feel in general.
Yeah.
Still very suit and tie, slick.
Yeah.
You know, flash cars rocking up on people's driveways. I don't know. I think they could have fundamentally take their business and start again almost.
Really?
Because they've got so many things going on there that I think they're going to have a really challenging time. I never admire business where the advisor is the hero of the story. We take credit for stuff clients do.
Yeah.
Ultimately, I'm not saving their money. They are.
Yeah.
You know, we need to recognize that we're there to guide people. We're not the hero of the story.
Yeah.
And if your own self-importance come across as more important than the client's needs, then I personally think you shouldn't be an advisor.
What's your image of the whole industry, the advisor? I mean, what, when you speak to other advisors, how do they kind of react to these kind of statements?
I don't think I'm alone in thinking like
no,
this.
No, you're definitely not.
I love our industry and I love our profession.
Yeah.
I think, unfortunately, you have to be quite hard-hitting with what you say sometimes to make a point.
Yeah.
And because we don't listen.
Yeah.
We don't listen to our customers. We don't listen to what we see as trends. We don't listen to what other people are doing outside of our industry. And yeah, sometimes it means, you know, having to be very blunt with how you critique it.
Mm.
But I do it as a critical friend. I believe we can be better. I believe we can be a better industry. And that's what drives me. Does it make me sound like I'm trying to say advisors are rubbish? No, I don't think so. I think there's an enormous amount of brilliant advisors out there. I just think there's too few of us, and I think it's too difficult to service everyone.
Yeah. Do you see that changing?
I think technology is going to be enormous.
Yeah.
The innovations that can come from opportunities in technology is massive and it's underexplored. I think we innovate to make our lives easier, not to make our clients' lives easier.
Yeah.
And if we can shift to that, I think we'll have something much more powerful.
Talk to me about Money Means.
So I just found it really difficult to not notice how big this problem is and really trying to look at the market and see what I felt was missing.
Mm.
And I think the genuine value of advice has got nothing to do with products. I think that's been clear.
Yeah.
And I felt like there's a real gap to really look at how people engage with services at the moment and the things that they use and how they use it and what really helps them. And I think we've missed a trick. So I've built a financial planning subscription service that's genuinely trying to help people move forward, take action, do stuff, get ready, make better decisions. And it links across all the fundamentals that we have always as planners really advocated, you know, controlling your daily finances and making sure you're okay and living within your means, not having high interest debt, having a safety net through, you know, having some money to fall back on and insurances. And also making sure you look at the future. And it's a tricky tightrope that an investment proposition is not going to help someone do. You need to tell them what to do and you need to help them work out what's the best thing to focus on without overwhelming them. You know, it's much more rewarding for me to help someone with no savings be £9,000 better off in a year than to, you know, help people who's already got the ability to afford to pay huge fees be better off. It's just intrinsically more important to me.
Yeah. You're very, I suppose, active in the industry when it comes to change, you know, and making it sort of a nicer industry for everybody. So I think in 2021, you wrote a letter to the CII calling for them to change their stance on bullying. Can you talk me through, like, what have you seen in financial services? First of all, why is it a hotbed for bullying? Secondly, I mean, I suppose, have you experienced it? Have you seen it?
I'm enormously frustrated with our professional bodies because we have a code of ethics. We are trying to create a profession. Mm-hmm. We're trying to hold ourselves to high standards, yet they won't act on something that's blatantly discriminating. And actually, the complaint was related to a chartered financial planner who was SOLA registered, who made a comment to another person in our industry that was discriminatory.
Oh, gosh, right. Okay.
So the challenge is if you read our ethical code, that shouldn't happen.
Yeah.
But there's no, the CII and, you know, PFS really doesn't act on that.
Why do you think that is?
Because I suppose the view is that they shouldn't be policing these things. But generally speaking, I found their response incredibly weak. And I got a lot of industry support for that letter, which I'm grateful for, because actually I think fundamentally as an industry, we want to be better, but we still have a low percentage of women in the industry.
Yeah,
we have a lot of ridiculousness that we have to put up with.
Talk to me about the ridiculousness. What have you, can you give me anecdotally what you've seen?
I don't think that's a whole podcast in itself. I think fundamentally, it's still a boys' club.
Yeah.
And I think I'm nervous about saying that because actually I've got incredible support from male peers in the industry, but we still have to deal with things that is actually unacceptable.
Yeah.
And should be unacceptable.
Yeah.
And I'm yet to speak to a female in the industry who hasn't experienced some element of discrimination or some element of comments that's completely inappropriate. And I think I've turned it around as I'm underestimated. And I actually like that. Because they genuinely, in some characters in the industry, generally underestimate how far the world has moved and how backwards they are. I believe they are minority. I just believe collectively we don't act against it enough. The reason I wrote that letter was because I was fed up is the truth. You know, I couldn't stand watching that our own professional body didn't actually hold people accountable. I'm under no illusions they're going to start to.
So what happened with that tweet then? Did anything happen? Was there any?
There was a complaint.
Yeah.
They the outcome of that actually is that the CII told me that the person who I complained on behalf of pulled the complaint and they didn't. So nothing came off it, basically.
So that person is still.
So it was disappointing.
Yeah.
because they tried to brush it under the rug. It's not the first time. I made another complaint about a speaker who was highly inappropriate, and I had to push enormously hard for them to take that seriously.
Helena, thank you very much for coming in. You've been listening to The Advice Show with me, Victoria Bell, senior reporter at NMA, and we were joined today by Helena Wardle, CEO of Money Means. For any questions, please feel free to tweet us at New Model Advisor or email us at nmateam@citywire.co.uk. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next week.
But today is VE Day. The wise
newly crowned queen waves from the Belt.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has
tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth: cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Bailey Gifford. Capital at risk.